This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 10 years ago, Newt Gingrich was at the heart of the Republican Party's super successful Contract with America. He helped lead the GOP takeover of Capitol Hill, became a feisty and controversial Speaker of the House, gloried in that power, took some political and personal hits, and fell out of the spotlight. Now he's back with a new agenda for the country and its Republican majority, with some tough criticism for President Bush, and perhaps with some presidential ambitions of his own. Tonight on Point, Newt Gingrich with a new agenda for a new century. What's your question for Newt Gingrich? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Speaker Gingrich will join us shortly. Last September marked the 10th anniversary of the Contract with America. To consider its legacy, we turn to Washington and Gail Shattuck, congressional reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. Gail, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Tom. Good to be here.
So help us look back. We'll have Newt Gingrich in a moment, but through your repertorial lens, how do you see the legacy of that watershed moment and the Contract with America that Newt Gingrich was at the heart of? What's the legacy, Gail?
Well, it has a brilliant political legacy. It was a brilliant political stroke. You know, 6 weeks before a midterm election to bring about 350 candidates to the steps of the Congress to say, if we're elected, here is what we're going to do. They basically nationalized the election, you know, focused a lot of attention on the party, came back, took 54 seats, and took back power for the first time in 40 years. So as political drama, it was extraordinary. But if you look at what it intended to do, it's largely unfinished business. In that the whole purpose of the contract was to end government that's too big, too intrusive, and too easy with the public's money.
Mm-hmm. And frankly, Newt Gingrich's words, I think, those.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
There are about 100 conservative House members who are, I think, going to be a very interesting force in the next Congress, because they want to get back to some of those principles that the party in power after 10 years has gotten very much away from.
What is the sense of what was achieved and sustained and what was lost out of the Contract with America promises, Gail?
One of the things that was lost was the sense that a legislator ought to be a citizen, come in for a short time and leave. What we found was that many members of that class of 94, while some did leave, as I said they would, others stayed on. And some of the term limits for speaker, for example, were softened. Exemptions have been made for some committee chairmen. So gradually, the perks of power are creeping back. But overall, I think the sense that conservative means is to take a big whack at big government. That's the piece that has also grown under, in the last 10 years, the Department of Education, for example, that these insurgents had wanted to get rid of altogether, is much stronger than it ever was before. The deficit is larger, and pork barrel spending is light years more than it was when they came in. So the party in power is not quite the same thing as the insurgent party, and the gap is what the fight is going to be about in the next Congress.
And you're talking about a fight within the Republican Party. What's the locus of this kind of resistance to the evolution of the party since the Contract with America in 94? Who's at the heart of that today?
Look at Mike Pence, now going into his third term from Indiana. He is one of 25 Republicans who voted against the Medicare Act, and now the extension of Medicare, rather, into prescription drugs. And now he wants to roll it back. He has about 106 members in that caucus, some of whom I've talked to are saying that they're willing to go up against the leadership on points of principle. They were elected on principle. They like the Contract with America. They want to get back to its spirit.
And what about the ethics issues that came up in the House just at the very beginning of this term? Ethics were a big push of the Contract with America as well. The charge that it had become, the House had become corrupt under Democratic leadership, Republicans out to turn that around.
That's right. That was another aspect of the political theater of Newt Gingrich, to, at a time when no one thought Republicans would ever take back power, to start hammering at the ethics, that the Democrats had become a party fat, contented with power, and abusing it, and they didn't deserve to govern, which is why to have an issue with the majority leader, Tom DeLay, so prominent the opening day of session was a very hard thing on some of these conservatives. They don't like the fact that in the last a month ago, the Republicans had voted to end a rule started at that time, mm-hmm. that any member who is criminally indicted has to give up his position. The Republicans voted out that rule, then heard, got an earful, many of them from their constituents, came back and had to reverse their position. Tom DeLay lost a lot of political capital on that, mainly because it made Republicans look like the Democrats that they displaced.
Gail, talk to us about Newt Gingrich himself. He was right there on the ramparts in 94. Talk to us about the way he faded from the scene in Washington and what Washington's making of his higher profile very recently.
Well, he faded from the scene in the sense that he stepped down with a lot of criticism, both about his personal life and about the way he handled himself as leader, that there were members who were tired of, you know, the iron hand of leadership, and they just wanted to move on. Dennis Hastert.
He had an ugly divorce and sort of married an employee or colleague,
yeah,
an assistant.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. In the context of Monica Lewinsky and Congressman Livingston stepping down, it wasn't part of the image that Republicans wanted of family values. It looked bad. But, you know, like President Nixon, he really, behind the scenes, continued to be a very strong intellectual presence. I mean, he is a force of nature. He reads voluminously. He's got ideas about everything. I remember just a couple of years after he stepped down, actually shorter than that, just a year. I was in a group where he was talking to Republicans about how they weren't going to survive as a party unless they reached out to Hispanics, and that would involve rethinking some of their positions on immigration and rethinking what it meant to be a conservative Republican, not just, you know, a white guy. You had to really expand your notion of what a Republican was.
So always a big generator of ideas, and now the idea of Newt Gingrich in the national spotlight, maybe even a presidential spotlight. How does that resonate in Republican circles?
Well, I think it's certainly a very controversial move. Leaders are supposed to fade away. There are many others who aspire to take his place, and I can't see any of them very eager to give up that space.
And yet, as you say, Newt Gingrich always kind of a force of nature.
He is. No, he is not boring. He's interesting to listen to. Now, whether or not the base is going to buy someone coming back, you know, on the cover of this book, there's a picture with his new wife, and you know, it just raises issues that go beyond the intellectual power he brings to the party, and you really have to win back that base. President Bush has a tie to the affections of the base that is very deep and strong. It's going to be hard for anybody to replace that, and I think Newt brings to it some baggage that would make that harder.
But never a dull moment, and always an idea that's new. Gail Chadwick, thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
Gail Chadwick covers Congress for the Christian Science Monitor. Joining me now from Washington is Newt Gingrich. From 1995 to 99, he served as Speaker of the House of Representatives. He was the architect of the Contract with America, which helped lead to an historic Republican Party victory in 94. The GOP captured a majority in the House of Representatives for the first time in 40 years and still has it. Gingrich was first elected to Congress in 1978 and represented Georgia's 6th District for 20 years. He's an historian and prolific writer. His new book out this week is Winning the Future, a 21st Century Contract with America. Good evening and welcome, Newt Gingrich.
How are you?
Very well. We last talked with you at the Republican Convention in New York. Lots of hubbub there. Your man won. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. It was quite a campaign, wasn't it?
It was quite a campaign. If you loved it, it was terrific. If you didn't, it was hell, but it was quite a campaign. And here you are on the other side of that Newt Gingrich at a time when the Republicans have got it all, and we're hearing Republican rumbling from within the GOP ranks. In some way, you're a part of that on the other side of the election, taking a few shots at the president. The same, lots of credit to him that you're giving, but also some complaints about Iraq and elsewhere. What's your assessment of the job the president's doing right now? Where it's strong, where it's not?
Look, I think overall the president's doing a very good job. But I think if you're going to be a governing majority, you also have to be willing to talk about things that can be done better or things where we've made mistakes. And if you look at the absolutely brilliant job that the president and his team did in Afghanistan, where 3 weeks after we went in, we had conversations. We found Karzai, who was an Afghan leader. He became the leader of the interim government. Nobody in Afghanistan ever thought that we were occupiers, and we're there today in a very successful partnership. And you compare that with what happened in May and June of 2003 in Iraq, where we were on the same track to do the same things, and we had a plan that would have kept the Iraqi regular army in service to police the country so young Americans weren't policing the country. We made a mistake. Now, I mean, if you know, I think you can be very loyal to the team. You know, I'm a Green Bay Packers fan, and yet I have to confess that last Sunday night, Brett Favre threw four interceptions. Now, it doesn't seem to me I've got to jump up and down and say, no, he didn't.
You did.
You know, and yet I can still think he's a fabulous quarterback and a great symbol of the best of football and a great family man and somebody I admire a great deal. But he threw four interceptions that night. What are you supposed to say? No, he didn't.
In your book, Winning the Future, you put most of that on the hook of Paul Bremer, who, of course, was President Bush's appointee. But how do you see responsibility flowing through?
Actually, in the book, I don't. And I don't think we even mentioned Bremer's name in the book.
Oh, excuse me. I thought
That's been newspaper interviews. But because I specifically didn't think, when we went through and wrote the book, I didn't think it's fair, and I don't want anyone to think about this as a hunt for scapegoats. That's exactly wrong. What we've got to do is learn lessons of what works, what doesn't work, do it in a calm, professional manner, and recognize that on future occasions, there are things that work we should do, and there are things that don't work we shouldn't do. But we should neither be afraid to talk publicly about having made mistakes, nor should we scapegoat people. Paul Bremer is a very sincere, very decent man who has served his country very ably. He left a very good private sector job. He voluntarily went to Iraq. He risked his life for 15 months. And everybody should respect him, even if we might say there were some places that things could have been done better.
You say when Bremer arrived, he thought he was MacArthur in Japan. He thought he had 5 years to build an Americentric model. Turns out, as you note, he just didn't have that time.
That's right. And that was an honest mistake. I mean, that's my whole point, is I think you've got to look at what are the honest mistakes and how do we learn from them, and how do we try not to repeat them? On the other hand, what we did in Afghanistan, what President Bush led in Afghanistan, was brilliant.
Newt Gingrich, we just heard from Gail Shattuck. We want to hear from you about this rumbling within the GOP again about government spending and the size of government under George W. Bush. You wrote recently in the Washington Post saying the Republicans have to be honest about performance failures. Do you point to that as another performance failure? How do you see it?
Well, I think, first of all, we had 9/11, which led to a great deal of spending on a variety of places, Homeland Security, National Defense. Homeland and 9/11 further deepened the recession, which reduced federal revenues. And I, frankly, felt in 2002 and 2003 that I preferred a deeper deficit because I was very worried about deflation. And I thought it was better for us to pull the economy back out of recession, get back to economic growth, and then go to work on the balanced budget, which is exactly where we are now. I'm very pleased that in general, while I disagree on some details, in general, as I understand it, the president's upcoming budget is going to be much tighter fiscally. I think that's probably what it should be. I'm also very pleased that Chairman Jerry Lewis, the new chairman of the Appropriations Committee from California, has indicated that he is committed to meeting the requirements of the budget. And I think that that's, very powerful. I think that they're moving in the right direction. I make two points in the book on balancing the budget, other than the fact that it is a moral imperative and we should do it in peacetime. One is that you have to transform the health system if you're going to balance the budget, because health is the fastest growing cost center in government, both federal and state. And in the long run, you're going to have terrible budget problems unless you fix it. The other is that we have to face the reality that some of the budget rules don't work very well. You know, you can't have a budget and then, by the way, always have supplementals.
Newt Gingrich, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We'll come back and get more of your agenda for the 21st century. Newt Gingrich with us tonight. You can join the conversation. What's the Gingrich footprint in Washington, in America today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with the Republicans' 1990s firebrand, Newt Gingrich, back with a new agenda for a new century. His book is Winning the Future, a 21st Century Contract with America. You can join the conversation tonight. New Hampshire and Iowa listeners, are you ready to think about President Gingrich? And what is the Gingrich footprint in Washington, in America today? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Newt Gingrich, we want to hear about your new contract, but if you humor us for a moment, just to look back at the epic contract with America in 1994. Recently, we've got some Republicans complaining about the way that's all panned out. Christopher Shays, Republican from Connecticut, saying, you know, he expected a higher standard. Here he's talking with Business Week, saying Republicans have backtracked on term limits central to the contract with America. They've engaged in verbal acrobatics to justify record budget deficits, expanded pork barrel spending, twisted rules to marginalize the minority. This is a Republican. How big is that sentiment, that kernel of sentiment in the GOP today?
Well, I think that there are people who are concerned, and I think that some of the concerns are legitimate. Look, I think you always have a tension once you become the governing party between your reform wing and sort of your daily governance wing. And the daily governance wing gets a habit of doing what's easy and what they can get away with, while the reform wing really does find it very, very difficult to tolerate that, because there's a different set of values, a different set of concerns.
Will it hold together for President Bush's second-term agenda, or have we got a crevice here of note?
Oh, I think they do. I think that in the long run we have so much more that binds us. And frankly, part of the reason I wrote the whole concept of winning the future, a 21st century contract with America, was because I wanted to be in a position where we could offer to all of our members some bold new ideas, some bold new suggestions, some bold new solutions. And I think that both for the reform wing and for the sort of daily governing wing, that there's a lot of stuff in here that they can use that will be very useful.
Give us a little compare and contrast. How does your new agenda compare with the Contract for America 94? What's the same? What's new on the Newt Gingrich screen here?
Well, this is, with the singular exception of balancing the budget, which was in both of them, this is really substantially different. In 1994, we were standing on Ronald Reagan's shoulders. In 1994, we'd had 30 years of Reagan from his first great speech in November of 1964. He taught us about welfare reform. He taught us about balanced budgets. He taught us about tax cuts. He taught us about stronger military. Now we're entering a new world. And in addition to the Social Security personal savings accounts, which President Bush has very correctly been advocating and which I strongly support, it seems to me we've got to confront how different the world is, and we've got to work to move towards new ideas and new proposals. And so I take national security issues, the question of the importance of our creator in defining America and American rights.
That is religion back in the center of things, you want it.
Exactly. I mean, the notion that if we say we are endowed by our creator with certain inalienable rights, which is in the Declaration of Independence, that has real meaning, and it makes us very different from most other countries. I think it's important for us to have patriotic education and patriotic immigration.
What do those two phrases mean?
Well, it means that young people should learn about George Washington. They should learn about the Constitution. They should learn about Thomas Jefferson. They should learn about Abraham Lincoln, that being an American is a learned cultural pattern. We're not genetically American. We're not like the Chinese or the Germans. We don't have a genetic base. We're not geographically American. If you happen to be dropped off in Maine or in New Orleans, you don't happen to automatically be American. We are a way of life. We're a way of the rule of law, the right to dream, the fact that our rights come from God, loaning power to people through elections. the work ethic. There are a whole series of things that make us American.
And you don't think American school kids are getting the history of George Washington and Abraham Lincoln
today? Absolutely not. If you look at test questions, even for college students, it is appalling how few of them know anything about America. Modern American schools do not believe in teaching about America. And modern American teachers very often have a bias that is contemptuous of the founding fathers.
Patriotic immigration. What do you mean by that, Newt Gingrich?
I mean that I'm very comfortable with people who want to come to America to work hard, to pay taxes, to obey the law, and I very much want them to have an opportunity to become citizens if they're prepared to learn American history and American values, and if they're prepared to learn English. And I think that we should be quite clear about that. That we want to, in the long run, be a country that respects other languages and respects other cultures, but we want people to learn to be American, and we want people to learn English as a part of the context of being an American.
Then you point to science and technology. You've always been a big backer on these. I wanted to ask you how you think that's going. We've had recently on the show David Baltimore, head of Caltech, and right here in Boston, the president of MIT, saying we've got big problems in American science. We see Congress cutting the budget for the National Science Foundation. We see the Republican Party kind of becoming associated with, at least in the eyes of many, an anti-science mentality. How do you see that?
Well, I'm very concerned about science in America. I very much believe that we should triple the size of the National Science Foundation. I very much believe that we should thoroughly overhaul math and science education for young people. I believe that we ought to move to have a dramatically more entrepreneurial system at NASA to get us into space faster and more dynamically. And in Winning the Future, I outline a whole series of changes that I think would make us a more competitive nation in the area of science. Remember that for the last 50 or 60 years, science has been the base of our economy. Science has been the base of our national security. Science has been the base of our growing knowledge about health. And I think it's a very big mistake for America to not invest consistently and steadily in creating a stronger science base for the future of the country.
Are you concerned that the fundamentalist Christian base within the Republican Party may prove an obstacle to that kind of research going forward?
I think it's that's like managing any coalition. We have to talk things out, and we have to recognize that on some issues people are going to disagree, but on the larger issues they can agree.
Stem cell research?
I personally believe that there should be a way to do stem cell research without in any way involving abortions, and I think that that's what most worries people who worry about the sanctity of life, is that they do not want to see people paid to have abortions in order to do stem cell research.
So are you saying don't touch embryonic stem cells or something different?
No, I'm saying that there are ways, and in fact, I've been looking at several new breakthroughs that have been discussed in President Bush's Committee on Biological Ethics that are encouraging that we may be able to find ways to actually create new lines of stem cells without violating the sanctity of life.
Interesting. Change the terms of the debate. Newt Gingrich, we've got callers who want to talk with you. Mark's calling from Wake Forest, North Carolina. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Good evening, gentlemen. And Mr. Gingrich, welcome back. We missed you.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
My question, I wanted to hear your thoughts on the Republican base. You touched on it, but if you can go into a little bit more detail, what are your thoughts as far as there's obviously two camps, more of a business-based and also a faith-based sides to the party, but do you see other parties or groups inside that are emerging, such as the Latino base?
Absolutely. I mean, for the Republican Party in the long run to be capable of governing the country, we have to have an inclusive policy. We have to include African-Americans who care about their country, who care about take-home pay, who care about jobs. Younger African-Americans would gain more from personal Social Security accounts than any other group in American society. We have to worry about including Hispanic-Americans who want to be able to buy a home, want to be able to create a job or found a business, who care very much about the savings rate and about their children's future. We have to be a party of inclusion for Asian Americans, many of whom are among the most dynamic and aggressive entrepreneurs in America. And we have to work with Native Americans to end a system which has frankly left so many Native Americans trapped in poverty and alcoholism and in death by suicide in a way that is just truly an American tragedy.
And what about the faith factor that Mark raises? I guess we come back to this, but that faction in the party has grown ever stronger. It's seen as totally consequential in the last election. Is that changing the Republican Party that you know in a way that you're comfortable with, Newt Gingrich?
Well, look, I, as I said earlier, I think it's a broad coalition. I think that there are people who represent a broad range of interest. I would say overwhelmingly, and I try to address this in the book, in the broadest question of faith, I think this is a country based on our rights having come from the Creator. That's what we say in the Declaration of Independence. And it's a very powerful term, and it makes us very different than almost any other country in the world. On the other hand, I know of no American who wants a theocracy. I think the right to practice your religious beliefs freely is integral to being an American.
And on the ethical front, is the Christian right standard one that's reasonable, that's going to keep politicians engaged in politics, or does it become too high a hurdle for people to get over?
No, I think most of the people I know who are Christian, I don't think there's anything wrong with a country wanting a high standard of ethics. I think that's a good thing for a country.
Let's get another call. Lance is calling from Viroqua, Wisconsin. Hi, Lance. You're on the air.
Hi there. Hi. Hello, Mr. Gingrich. I am understanding that 85% of that contract with America was implemented in the mid to late 90s, and I'm just wondering what your thoughts are on how that is with us yet today.
Well, I mean, the key parts of the contract with America, many of them were implemented. We had welfare reform. 60% of the people who are in welfare now are either at work or at school. That is a remarkable change. We balanced the federal budget for four consecutive years and paid off $405 billion in federal debt. It's the first time we had balanced the budget for four consecutive years since the 1920s. We had the first tax cut in 16 years. We strengthened defense. The 9/11 Commission reported that we had the only increase in intelligence spending in the 1990s. They called it the Gingrich Plus Up. It was $1 billion we insisted on giving to intelligence against the wishes of the Clinton administration. We did reform the Congress. There's now an annual audit of the U.S. Congress. Congress has to obey the same laws as small business. It's clearly there's still term limits for committee chairman, which we created back in 1995. So, you know, I would say I think probably we got 65 or 70% of the contract. If you look at things like the child tax credit was in the contract, it became law. We favored medical savings accounts. They're now health savings accounts. They're law. So there are a number of things that are in there that became law.
And what did you think as the House, led by Republicans, wrestled with peeling back ethics rules, loosening up ethics rules at the beginning of the session, and did some of that? Not as much as originally proposed, but were you having a conniption off stage?
I was saying publicly on stage I thought it was a mistake, and I was delighted when Tom DeLay listened to his colleagues and reversed his position and agreed to they repealed the change in the rules that they had passed. And I saw Tom last Friday night, and I told him I thought it was a very important thing he did and that it was exactly right for him to listen to his colleagues and recognize that that was a mistake. So I'm pretty comfortable. They refused to weaken the ethics rules. The one place that they changed the rules, frankly, the Democrats forced on them because the Democrats were basically cheating. The Democrats were using a clause that said if you don't both agree, there's an automatic investigation. So the Democrats were just guaranteeing there were always going to be investigations.
Brooke is calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Brooke. You're on the air.
Hi. My question is, or I guess it's more of a comment in response to Mr. Gingrich's remarks about American history and American values.
Yep.
And English is the American language. I'm a teacher myself, and I guess what his comments sort of make me afraid of is that we're a country that is characterized by change and by growth, and it makes me a little concerned when we sort of draw a line in the sand and go, okay, from this point forward, this is our history. It seems that we're not respecting or encouraging the growth that globalization makes possible.
So are you saying to move away from American history, or that you have to, what exactly are you suggesting, Brooke?
I guess I'm suggesting that while it is important to know where we come from, there are multiple perspectives that we need to value and honor and discuss in public education. There's certainly the historical canon of the white male-dominated view of things, but there are also lots of other views that are equally valid depending on your experience.
Brooke, we've got it, and our time is short. Newt Gingrich, how do you respond?
I just think Brooke's wrong. I think to compare the lessons of the Founding Fathers, the lessons of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and others who created the most powerful system of human freedom in the history of the human race, I mean, there's no society on the planet that absorbs people from everywhere the way we do, gives them a chance to prosper and rise and integrate into a single society, and gives them a chance to pursue happiness. And I think to not study and not immerse yourself in the lessons of Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson and George Washington and John Adams and Abraham Lincoln, and not have some sense of the uniqueness of America, it doesn't help you towards globalization. It helps you towards a mess.
Does your contract for the 21st century leave open the flexibility to welcome in not only the Hispanics and others that you say you're extending your hand to, but something of their cultural and themselves?
Sure. Look, we have been a country which has accepted people from all sorts of cultures for 400 years. You can be a Greek American. If you saw my big fat Greek wedding, you saw a perfect example of a community in which they were on the one hand wonderfully American and wonderfully Greek simultaneously.
Mm-hmm.
And that is absolutely the future of this country. But if you don't understand, if you don't study, why does America work when other countries don't? Why is it that if you're Kurdish and you're Sunni and you're Shia, but your kids go to school in America, they can play on the same soccer team and not hate each other? What is there about America that makes it so different? And that's worth studying.
Let's get another call. Peter's calling from Wayland, Massachusetts. Hello, Peter. You're on the air.
Hello, Mr. Gingrich.
How are you?
Hello, Tom. I'm all right. I'm wondering if America is ready for a leader with the kind of character that would enable him to divorce his wife on her deathbed.
Well, that's a lie. I'm not going to comment much on these things. That is a lie. So as long as we understand that's a lie, I'm actually pretty comfortable having the rest of this conversation. But if you want to just get on the air to repeat a series of lies that have been said over the years by people who don't like what I'm doing, that's your prerogative. It's a free country, but I don't have to put up with it, and I don't have to try to answer them. That was a lie.
Newt Gingrich, that chapter in your personal life must have been a burden for you in recent years. Is it behind you now? How do you find it when you get out on the hustings?
I find out on the hustings that unless they are hard, bitter political opponents, nobody asks about it and nobody cares. I found yesterday when I arrived at the Atlanta airport and my daughter and my two grandchildren met me that they were perfectly happy to see Grandpa. And I find that as a general rule, other than people who are hardened, bitter enemies, most people are thrilled to talk about ideas and not degenerate into personality attacks.
We've just got a minute left. How do you see your own party, its openness to ideas? You're an idea generator now compared to 1994.
I think my party is about 30 times more open to ideas than the Democrats. And I think the biggest challenge the Democrats face is to actually take books like this, read them and argue with them and think about them and not automatically default to whatever worked for liberalism 45 years ago. This country wants a strong, vibrant Democratic Party open to new ideas, just as it wants a strong, vibrant Republican Party open to new ideas. But we aren't going to solve the problems of the 21st century just by running 30-second attack commercials and learning how to smear each other. We're going to have to talk together.
And the stakes, in your view, if the U.S. doesn't step up to the kind of agenda you're outlining?
Then we won't remain America. I mean, if we're not careful, the terrorists could defeat us militarily by literally setting off nuclear weapons or biological weapons in our cities. If we're not careful, we could cease to understand America and cease to understand where our rights come from. And if we're not careful, we could cease to compete economically with China and India. So I think these are genuine challenges, and they're worthy of our having a real dialogue among our friends and among ourselves and really trying to talk about ideas for a couple of years before we get back to politics as usual.
Newt Gingrich, always interesting to catch up with you. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. Newt Gingrich, former Speaker of the House, author of the new book, Winning the Future, A 21st Century Contract with America. You can continue this conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. Coming up after the break, Steve Jobs and Apple try to take a bite out of the low end of the PC market. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. It's been a huge week for the computer company Apple. Yesterday, the company announced that its profits last quarter quadrupled compared to the same quarter a year ago, due largely to high Christmas sales of its iPod music player. Today, Apple's stock price surged near its all-time high, and on Tuesday, Apple unveiled the 6.5-inch wide, 2-inch tall Mac Mini, a less expensive version of its Macintosh computer. The Mini represents a daring move into budget computers for a company that controls just 2 or 3% of the personal computer market. Apple CEO Steve Jobs unveiled the Mac Mini during this week's Macworld Expo in San Francisco.
We want to price this Mac so that people that are, you know, thinking of switching will have no more excuses. People that want a second Mac in their household or a third or a fourth, really going to be easy. So there are two models of the Mac Mini. The first one is $499. And the second one adds a bigger hard drive and a faster processor for just $100 more at $599. These are the two models of the Mac Mini. This is the most affordable Mac ever. As a matter of fact, it's the cheapest computer Apple's ever offered.
Steve Jobs delivering the keynote address at the Macworld Expo in San Francisco earlier this week. Joining me to discuss Apple's big week are Nick Wingfield, staff writer for the Wall Street Journal, who was at the Macworld Expo. Nick, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
And John Gallagher, associate professor of information systems at Boston College's Carroll School of Management. John, great to have you as well.
Glad to be here, too.
Nick Wingfield, take us straight in here. What's going on with Apple? Everybody's just hopping up and down. Have they turned a corner? What's the vista that's opened up this week?
Well, the big change for this company in the past few years has been the iPod, which is a portable music player. They've sold about 10 million of them now, and it's really taken Apple from its roots as a computer company with a small and diminishing portion of the market into something very different. It's turned it really into a broad electronics retailer. I think it's made the company a lot more confident, and it's certainly made them a lot more financially healthy. So they're coming from a position of strength in this new kind of portable music player market. They're making a lot of money from it, and now they're actually trying to reinvigorate their Macintosh business, which is a much more mature business, and they're doing it by offering a low-priced Macintosh, something that they haven't done in the past. So it really is a turning point for the company.
John Gallagher, what's the horizon look like for this company? Is it possible that they would break out of the size that they've been for the last, you tell us, how many years and become something really different? Or are we looking at marginal shifts in the size and sort of weight of Apple?
Well, it's a very special time for Apple and in its history and to be able to take advantage of this. People refer to Microsoft as having a monopoly, but the natural state in this business is for there to be one dominant firm. You choose Windows because other people run Windows.
Mm-hmm.
The key problem that Microsoft has right now are people being repelled from its platform. Folks are finding their Windows PC experience to be less satisfying than ever before.
Why?
Bugs, viruses, spyware, mm-hmm. all of those things are pushing people away. The question is, can Apple jump on this and take advantage of it?
If Apple gets bigger, will it be vulnerable to the same kind of bugs and spyware that Windows systems see now? Or is it just the software just written differently, John?
Well, that's a good question. The software is definitely written differently. There's a Unix base to Mac. Apple is very proud of the fact that they've had almost no viruses over the past few years, and Microsoft cringes every time the press comes out with the daily virus reports. Now, the interesting thing about the Apple gambit is they also recognize that there's a big shift that Nick had mentioned. Digital music, and coupled with that is digital photography. A lot of folks are adopting photography and digital music, but unless you're using a Mac or an iPod, you're probably not completely satisfied with that experience. Apple wants you to adopt their products as well, and they hope that welds you to the platform.
Nick Wingfield, how does the new Mini figure in to all this? What's the importance of this, and what is the product like? Describe it for us.
The product is, I don't know, about the size of a small box, you know, of chocolates, a thick box mm-hmm. of chocolates. It has a very sort of elegant design. It doesn't have a fan, so it's incredibly quiet. You could actually put this thing in your living room, and it wouldn't be a nuisance. You know,
why doesn't it need a fan? Is it just that small? Or?
Yeah, I think they've just managed to make it incredibly quiet. They've designed the electronics to be a really, you know, to slip sort of easily into the living room.
And who's it aimed at? What kind of user? With what kind of usage?
Well, there are a couple different markets. One is the switcher market. These are PC users, Windows PC users, who for the reason that were discussed earlier, people are sick of Windows and want to move to a Macintosh. It's cheap. They can take their it doesn't come with a monitor or a keyboard, so you can take your monitor or keyboard from your PC and add it on to this Macintosh. Then there's also, you know, current Apple users who probably want to buy a second or third computer for their home. So those are really two big audiences.
And what can they do with the Mini?
Well, they can do pretty much anything that you can do with an ordinary Macintosh. It doesn't have quite as much horsepower as the high-end Macs. It comes with a DVD player. It doesn't come with a DVD burner. It comes with a CD recorder. And most importantly, it comes with a suite of Apple applications that it calls iLife, which include iTunes, a photo application, a music application. These are really popular applications among Mac users, and they aren't applications you can get on Windows, with some exceptions. So that's really, I think they're going after an audience of kind of media junkies that are into digital music, into digital video, and into photos for sure.
So for people who want to do some word processing, use the internet, listen to music, use the kind of entertainment facilities, this little box, and it is remarkably small, it's enough.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't think you're necessarily going to switch if you're just into word processing. The Mini will do all of that, but it's really these media applications that are going to attract people to the new device from Apple.
So, John Gallagher, then how does this tiny box position Apple to Microsoft? Is it suddenly a real different kind of threat, or is it still kind of a gnat around the elephant?
Well, Macworld was really about the consumer experience. In fact, one of the interesting things about it was almost devoid of corporate announcements. Now, a lot of people have chosen Windows PCs simply because that's the PC they were using in their office. But if there's increasing frustration around these kinds of life applications, and Apple calls them iLife, then they've got an opening for them. This opening might be a little bit longer and more significant than folks have predicted, too, because the next big innovative piece of software from the Windows platform is codenamed Longhorn. Now, the geeks are making fun of this. They're saying, okay, it's been pushed back, so we should call it Long Wait, or they're saying features are removed from it, so let's call it Shorthorn. All these things come together and, again, create this sort of unprecedented opportunity for Apple. Now, Microsoft's a tough firm to compete against. A lot of people refer to them as the Freddy Krueger of software.
Yeah.
I think you got them killed, and they've got
they're back.
Lot of cash. So, you know, I wouldn't write them out completely. And I'm not certain that Apple is going to make a lot of inroads into the corporate market. But there seems to be that shift in lifestyle computing right now, and Apple is perfectly positioned for it.
Is Longhorn Microsoft's attempt to get in on the lifestyle computing?
Well, they will certainly have some features for that in a consumer release, which is coming forward. But again, we're seeing some flux in the initial specification. It looked like they were going to have a very robust file system that was pulled out of the spec, too. So given this uncertainty here, I think it really provides an opportunity for Apple. And the other key piece of Apple is that they launched a strategy which has been wildly successful for them, the Apple Store. This is a strategy that a lot of folks, myself included, didn't think was going to work.
You're talking physical stores in malls around the country.
Absolutely. They've opened scores of these. In fact, I think it was their 101st was recently opened in London, their largest store. And they've been wildly successful in pushing the product. And an innovative company really sometimes has to provide a way to educate customers. A lot of times, you know, the store reps in a company like Best Buy wouldn't be familiar with the Mac or with the iPod. And now you've got Apple stores that are out there. They've got rabidly evangelical customers. And people are dropping by. They may be buying this $99 MP3 player or digital music player. And Apple's hope is that they can migrate them up to cheap Macs, more expensive Macs, and all the associated high-margin products that go along with those.
Nick Wingfield, how do you see the potential implications for Microsoft and for computer users more generally then? If maybe not on the corporate side, but on the life application side, Apple begins to take a bigger and bigger bite here.
Well, I think one of the most exciting areas, a possibility for them, is this market that that the iPod is playing in. The iPod really, I think most people see, is just one of many other possible devices. I mean, there's a great battle in the living room now, not just between Microsoft and Apple, but between Sony and between a number of other companies that would like to kind of control, you know, to be your hub for digital entertainment. So a key thing to watch with Apple is to see if they, you know, if they try to expand this iPod franchise into something more. And that's an area that Microsoft very much wants to play in. They're looking for new areas of growth. They have, you know, 90+% share of the market. And, you know, corporate spending is kind of slow right now. So they really would like to capture this, you know, this consumer sort of transformation that's going on right now in homes where people are consuming more and more digital entertainment.
Entertainment at home, and yet it's big business. Steve Jobs, once again, seems like the creative flame right at the heart of this. John Gallagher, of course, he was gone from Apple for a long time, came back. How do you describe the Jobs 2 era of Apple, his impact?
You know, it was interesting. Apple was a firm that sort of launched graphical computing, and then Microsoft came and took it away. And they took it away during the non-job era. During that time, Apple was seen as a less innovative firm. And many people that were rabid Mac fans, the old bleeding six-color Mac fans, left the Apple platform when the Internet came around. Apple was really caught sleeping during the Internet wave, and innovations like Java showed up first on the Windows platform. Now there's this other shift in computing, this shift to digital media consumption, digital photography, digital music. And Apple sees this happening, and they want to be the key innovator in this space.
You know, Nick, I also can't help thinking about what I guess is Steve Jobs' design sense. Apple's products just always look so cool, and maybe that shouldn't mean anything. After all, does that relate to their function? Maybe not, but they make such an impact visually in design terms. It's incredible. Is that him? Is he the driver on that?
He is so involved in design decisions. I mean, somebody told me a story about walking through one of the first Apple stores, the physical stores, and Jobs was there, and this person that I was talking to said he pointed to Jobs and said, you know, you pick the color of this glass, this beautiful frosted glass inside the store, and Jobs said, yeah, in fact, he was involved in that level of decision making. He's got an incredible design sense. Anybody who's ever bought an iPod knows that when you unpackage the package for the iPod, that in itself is a real experience. So it's about everything. I mean, even the packaging for the Mini this week, and for the new iPod Shuffle, which is the new iPod from the company, it just shows an incredible attention to detail there. And I think he feels like it really matters. And certainly among the people who are buying these devices today, it matters. I mean, they're really fashion objects as much as hubs for digital entertainment.
Steve Jobs had a fight with cancer not so long ago that he apparently won. Do you see a difference in his outlook on life, on the company, on the world, on his products after that?
You know, I haven't noticed a radical change. I mean, he looks healthy. He certainly looked very skinny for a point. He looks like he may have gained a little weight back. So he looks healthy to me. I haven't had a chance to talk to him about whether it's changed his outlook, but you know, he seems to be having a very good time. I mean, we forget he's also the CEO of another company, Pixar, which is riding an incredible, you know, unbroken string of successes, most recently The Incredibles. So everything's really going very well for him at this point, and he doesn't seem to have any complaints at all.
John Gallagher, when corporate historians look back on the era we've just come through and these two great computer figures, Steve Jobs and Bill Gates, what kind of comparison do you think they're likely to draw?
Well, this is an interesting change in Apple strategy. They are using low-end products, and they're likely low-margin products, to try to fuel demand for higher-margin accessories and to move them up the food chain. I think they also want to weld them into the company, too. I would be surprised to see Apple having massive market share gains, but they really are changing and grabbing this new segment of the market. I think people will also look at Apple, and they'll see that this is a company which is structured a bit differently. Their marketing people, the chief marketer at Apple, a guy named Phil Schiller, was deeply involved with the engineers of the company and with Jobs himself in the design of the iPod. So unlike other firms where there may be silos, Apple really tries to integrate their marketing function, their product design function, their engineering function. And really, to Jobs' credit, he's built a firm that's tightly integrated and well-oiled to be able to pull that off.
Well, it's not easy to do. He's done it, and everybody celebrating and watching Apple this week. 4.5 million iPods sold during the last quarter of 2004. That's quite incredible. And now here comes the Mini. Nick, when will we have first Minis on the market, and when will we be getting a sense of how fast they're selling?
Well, they're coming out later this month, so when Apple reports its calendar first quarter, then we'll really get a sense. But this year, I think, is going to be really key. Apple has this new Mini. They have a new iPod, and it's going to be really key to see whether they're able to sustain this momentum. You know, Apple's problem has not been creating innovative products. It's sort of been, you know, creating innovative products and keeping that pipeline of products going. And I think, this year is going to be really key for them. We're going to start to see a lot more competition.
Nick, we'll be watching. We've got to go tonight, though. Thanks so much for joining us. Nick Wingfield with the Wall Street Journal joining us from San Francisco, and John Gallagher in Seattle with Boston College's Carroll School of Management. Thanks for being with us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.